very much. It's a great pleasure to have been invited here. I'm very glad to give the talk on Last of the Sydney Greats. So, as Clive said, I'm a philosopher, and so I'm interested in the origin of species, primarily for what it can tell us about philosophy and for what philosophers have said about it. Now, you might think from the outset that that's a very suspicious kind of agenda to have. What's the origin of species got to do with philosophy? Isn't it primarily a work of natural history? Aren't I guilty of imposing some kind of spurious agenda on the work? That impression, that skeptical impression, will be reinforced by a lot of the things that Darwin says about his own work. So you might think that, after all, Darwin describes himself as a philosophical naturalist. He aspired to become a philosophical naturalist. Those were his own terms. But of course, when Darwin says he wants to be a philosophical naturalist, he doesn't, unfortunately, mean a naturalist who's also interested in philosophy or a naturalist who wants to turn biological work to philosophical ends. A philosophical naturalist is more like a technical term at work in the mid part of the 19th century, whereby it simply means a naturalist, someone who studies nature, who isn't content merely to catalogue, merely to describe the various species that inhabit the earth, but instead somebody who wants to give some kind of underlying explanation for why species should take the forms they do, why we should see the characteristic distribution of organisms around the earth in the way that we do. That's what makes a naturalist philosophical. It's a naturalist who seeks to systematize, who seeks to explain rather than merely to describe. Because, of course, Darwin himself wished to come up with some kind of explanation for why it is that we should see the patterns in nature that we do. So there's not much even in Darwin's own stated ambition of being a philosophical naturalist to link his work to works in philosophy that we might understand today. And in fact, things get even worse for my agenda when you read more of what Darwin has to say about his own philosophical abilities and about philosophy in general. So in Darwin's own autobiography, he describes himself as a kind of philosophical airhead. He says, quoting, looking back on his life, "My power to follow a long and purely abstract train of thought is very limited. I should, moreover, never have succeeded with metaphysics or mathematics." Now, I think that's definitely false modesty on Darwin's part. After all, he had no difficulty marshalling a large argument. He thought of the origin of species itself as one long argument. He had no problem with keeping an extended train of thought on the rails. Now, of course, the origin of species is crammed full of hard-won empirical data. And I think that probably when Darwin is rude about philosophy, it's not so much that he has trouble keeping track of an argument, but rather he is very skeptical of the value of arguments that don't also rest on plenty of facts. So, take as an example, the disappointment that Darwin expressed when he read some of his own grandfather's pseudo-evolutionary speculations. So consider, for example, Erasmus Darwin's Zoonomia. Charles Darwin, dismissed it, quote, again, "the proportion of speculation being so large compared with the facts given." He also had this to say about his Victorian contemporary Herbert Spencer, who was exceptionally highly regarded at the time. Darwin said, "After reading any of his books, I generally feel enthusiastic admiration for his transcendent talents and have often wondered whether in the distant future he would rank with such great men as," and he gives some philosophers' names, "Descartes, Leibniz, etc., about whom, however, I know very little. Nevertheless, I am not conscious of having profited in my own work by Spencer's writings. His deductive manner of treating every subject is wholly opposed to my frame of mind. His conclusions never convince me. And over again, I have said to myself after reading one of his discussions, he would be a fine subject for half a dozen years' work." What Darwin wants is facts rather than unanchored speculation. And in general, Darwin was very harsh in the way that he judged people who speculated without a proper grounding in fact. This, I think, is really what explains why Darwin was so dismissive of what philosophers had to say. You might think this is sour grapes. Darwin read a very negative review of The Origin of Species, published in 1860 by a man called Francis Bowen, who was a professor of philosophy at Harvard University. Darwin then wrote in 1861, 2 years after The Origin was published, to Asa Gray, a friend of his, also a professor at Harvard. Gray, however, was a professor of botany. And Darwin says this about Bowen. He's not very impressed by the review. Darwin says, "You once spoke, I think, of Professor Bowen as a very clever man. I should have thought him a singularly unobservant and weak man from his writings. If he ever agrees with me on any one point, I shall conclude I must be in error on that. I believe Bowen is a metaphysician, and that, I presume, accounts for an entire want of common sense." So once again, Darwin extremely unimpressed by philosophical work. Now, I said this may be a case of sour grapes, though, because when Darwin instead finds himself praised by philosophers, he's actually rather pleased by it. So again, he wrote another letter to the same man, to his friend Asa Gray, a little bit later in the same year. Darwin was holed up on the English Riviera. He was enjoying probably not any sunshine, but at least enjoying Torquay at the time. And he said, "As no one has aided the subject of natural selection and the knowledge of my book so much as you, I must tell you what has pleased me much. After the many attacks on me for neglecting induction, Baconian philosophy, etc." Darwin says to Gray, "We in England think John Stuart Mill the highest authority on such subjects. And he said lately to a friend, who wrote to me, as follows. He considers that your reasoning throughout is in the most exact accordance with the strict principles of logic. He also says the method of investigation you have followed is the only one proper to such a subject. My wife's remark on reading this was, 'Why, you know nothing about logic. Is it not, I mean Mill's and not my wife's sayings, very satisfactory to me?'" Now, once again, the overwhelming sense that you get from all of this is of Darwin as someone who's entirely clueless about philosophy, who takes praise from philosophers when it comes, who gets grumpy when philosophers are rude about him, but all of this with no real effort at systematization. So why bother thinking of Darwin's work in an evolutionary light, in a philosophical light at all? Well, first of all, since Darwin wrote The Origin of Species, there's been an enormous proliferation of efforts on the part of mainstream philosophers to apply broadly Darwinian ideas to a whole array of subjects that you might more naturally think of as belonging within the domain of philosophy. So philosophers, for example, have tried to approach ethics, the growth of knowledge, even politics, from an evolutionary perspective. But it also turns out that Darwin himself did actually engage rather more closely than those superficial comments might suggest with philosophy. And indeed, Darwin even sought to find links between his own evolutionary work and work in ethics, the growth of knowledge, and so forth. Okay, so let me try and say a little bit more about the ways in which I think philosophical work contributes to or is expressed in The Origin of Species. Darwin did actually read rather a lot of philosophy. As a boy, he stayed at his uncle Josiah's house, that's Josiah Wedgwood, where Darwin met a man called Sir James Mackintosh. Now, Mackintosh's works are not very widely read today at all. However, in Victorian times, Mackintosh was rather a prominent philosopher. Darwin, as a boy, appeared to be very impressed by Mackintosh, and this view was reciprocated. Mackintosh also seemed to hold even the young Darwin in very high regard. Darwin later on, again in his autobiography, tried to explain Mackintosh's good opinion. Darwin says, "This must have been chiefly due to his perceiving that I listened with much interest to everything which he said, for I was as ignorant as a pig about his subjects of history, politics, and moral philosophy." Now, Darwin did later come to read philosophy in some detail. He looked at Immanuel Kant rather quickly, and the experience of reading Kant left him rather cold, as it has others. But straight after the Beagle voyage, when Darwin was still a young man, he read Adam Smith, and he read David Hume. Their work, I think, had a very significant influence later on Darwin's reflections on morality and the origins of the moral sense. He made very extensive notes on work by Mackintosh, and he also profited very considerably from reading Victorian methodologists of science, what we might think of as Victorian philosophers of science, people who told us how scientific work is supposed to be done. And I have in mind particularly Cambridge men like John Herschel and William Whewell. In his early 30s, Darwin became very excited about the potential philosophical promise of the evolutionary views that he was beginning to formulate. Very famously, in his notebook M, where the M stands for metaphysics, Darwin said, "Origin of man now proved, metaphysic must flourish. He who understands baboon would do more towards metaphysics than Locke." Now, Darwin's notebooks, the early notebooks prior to his writing The Origin of Species, are very rich in observations and speculations regarding a lot of the topics that philosophers today have tried to apply evolutionary thinking to. Those include, once again, the formation of our moral sense, the nature of emotional expression, the origins of innate knowledge, and so forth. But what about The Origin of Species? What about the book that we're supposed to be talking about today? Now, I think it's largely true that Darwin's thinking about these more speculative topics, psychology, morality, and so forth, mainly appeared in published forming works much later than The Origin of Species, works like The Descent of Man, or works like The Expression of Emotions in Man and Animals. Now, probably one of the reasons for this is that Darwin didn't want to run before he could walk, or at least not on the published public page. Darwin wanted to begin by establishing the basic credentials of his evolutionary views before trying to develop these more speculative, exploratory extrapolations towards more philosophical matters. Part of his reason for taking that cautious approach is illustrated, I think, by the rather hostile reception that greeted another evolutionary work, namely the work Vestiges of the Natural History of Creation, which was anonymously published 15 years before The Origin of Species, published in 1844. Now, Vestiges was a very ambitious work, far more ambitious in scope than The Origin of Species would be. Vestiges tried to cover everything from the origins of the universe as a whole to the differences between men and women. And people working in science who Darwin had the greatest respect for were almost universally critical of Vestiges. They thought it was nonsense, they thought it was speculative, they thought it was even irresponsible and potentially dangerous. So Darwin's idea, partly in writing The Origin, was to be altogether more sober, altogether more grave, altogether more contained in what he was prepared to say than the much more expansive reflections he'd already laid out in his own notebooks. He offered a very broad variety of data to support his evolutionary view, and by and large, he restricted his view to adaptation and speciation in plants and animals. He didn't even speculate on the origins of life, let alone the origins of the universe. Now, in spite of all this, I don't think The Origin of Species is actually entirely silent on matters of broad significance. Those might include divine design, the nature of the mind, and the nature of morality. Now, the most obvious sense in which The Origin of Species touches directly on what you might think of as a philosophical issue is that Darwin's book provides a defense of what he would have called a transmutationist view, an evolutionary view, the thought that species descended one from another to form a large tree, a defense of a transmutationist view against the view of special creation, against the view that species are individually brought into existence by the action of an intervening creator. Darwin, it's important to stress, was not an atheist when he wrote The Origin of Species. In fact, Darwin would never describe himself as an atheist. Nonetheless, he tackles head-on the question of whether or not one needs to invoke the intervention of a creator when trying to explain the immediate origin of species. And he comes to the view that these kinds of explanations are entirely vacuous. Here's what he says towards the end of The Origin. It's so easy to hide our ignorance under such expressions as the plan of creation, unity of design, etc., and to think we give an explanation when we only restate a fact. There's really no explanation offered, Darwin thinks, by these broadly creationist views. Now, that's the most obvious way in which The Origin of Species touches on these matters of very broad interest. Darwin also briefly explores the action of natural selection on instincts in animals in The Origin. And this hints at Darwin's later, more explicitly expressed view that evolutionary speculation will help to shed origin on the nature of the human mind. Darwin doesn't really develop these ideas until later, until his book The Descent of Man. But nonetheless, he tells the reader that they should be in no doubt as to what his theory could potentially achieve. So here's what he says, again, towards the end of The Origin. He says, in the distant future, I see open fields for far more important researches. Psychology will be based on a new foundation, that of the necessary requirement of each mental power and capacity by gradation. Light will be thrown on the origin of man and his history. So there's talk in The Origin about creationism, there's talk in The Origin about the potential application of these ideas to the mind, but there's also prefiguring The Origin of what Darwin will later say in The Descent of Man about how he thinks an evolutionary stance can help to explain the origins of the moral sense in humans. And when Darwin talks about the moral sense, he means the sense that we have that there is a difference between right and wrong, and some of our more specific dispositions to view certain actions as morally right and others as morally wrong. Later in The Descent of Man, Darwin will argue that the good of the community, again his phrase, should be identified as the criterion of morality. In other words, Darwin says later in The Descent of Man that what makes an action right is its contribution to the good of the community. And by the good of the community, Darwin understands, quoting again, the means by which the greatest possible number of individuals can be reared in full vigour and health, with all their faculties perfect, under the conditions to which they are exposed. Now, he makes an elaborate case for this in The Descent of Man, and this is based in part on Darwin's view that we should understand natural selection working not at the level of individual organisms, but instead selection acting on whole communities of organisms in such a way that social instincts come to be favoured, social instincts which themselves tend to promote the good of those communities. Darwin, in other words, is espousing an early form of what we might think of now as group selection. Now, this set of views, once again, is foreshadowed, I think, in The Origin of Species. For example, in this arresting passage, where Darwin says the following, it may be difficult, but we ought to admire the savage, instinctive hatred of the queen bee, which urges her instantly to destroy the young queens, her daughters, as soon as born, or to perish herself in combat. For undoubtedly, this is for the good of the community. And maternal love or maternal hatred, though the latter fortunately is most rare, is all the same to the inexorable principle of natural selection. So Darwin says we ought to admire the queen bee's hatred. He says this in The Origin of Species, because that hatred, Darwin thinks, is good for the bee's community. So Darwin is not wholly silent on these more speculative issues in The Origin, even though largely he saves the philosophical stuff for later in his career, or alternatively, largely packs it into his notebooks where he feels he can express himself more freely. So I suppose there are two big messages that I want to try and bring out today. One is the claim I've already tried to make, namely that in spite of some of Darwin's protestations to the contrary, his work really is philosophically engaged, even The Origin of Species, which in some sense feels like one of the more philosophically neutral works, still touches on these philosophical interests. There's another point, though, that I want to make about looking back to Darwin, and that is what I think is the very important message, that we need to keep a very firm grip on the differences between what we might think of as modern Darwinism, the kind of view that defines people as Darwinians today, and what we might think of as Darwin's own views, Darwin's own Darwinism. So just to illustrate this, you might well think of, you know, if you say, who unquestionably counts as a Darwinian in modern times, right? The kind of person that you're going to mention is someone like Richard Dawkins. Okay, Dawkins looks like the classic example of a modern Darwinian. But in many ways, Dawkins' views are really different to those of Darwin. So fair enough, Dawkins doesn't say that natural selection is the only evolutionary force that can possibly operate. But Dawkins certainly seems to think that natural selection is far away the most important evolutionary force, and he does think it's the only force that explains interesting phenomena. Anything else Dawkins thinks is just boring. Dawkins also thinks, of course, that inheritance is largely a matter of the passing on of genes. More generally, these days, it's very common to contrast a Darwinian view of inheritance with a so-called Lamarckian view of inheritance. If you're a Darwinian, you're someone who rejects Lamarckism, and vice versa, so the thought goes. What's a Lamarckian? A Lamarckian is somebody who believes in the so-called inheritance of acquired characteristics. So this is illustrated using the thought that the blacksmith spends his life hammering away at an anvil. Because of this, his biceps grow bigger and bigger and bigger. That's an acquired characteristic. The size of biceps is acquired during the life of the smith. And because he's acquired these larger biceps, somehow those expanded biceps are passed on for free to the blacksmith's offspring. That's what inheritance of acquired characteristics means. The Lamarckian is supposed to be someone who thinks that that kind of thing can work. And of course, we good Darwinians know that that couldn't possibly work. There's no way in which expanded biceps could somehow be read back into the genome and then passed on to the offspring. So that's the sense in which we tend to contrast Darwinism with Lamarckism. Now, having said all that, it turns out that Darwin himself very frequently invokes Lamarckian forms of inheritance. Not only in his later work, he also invokes what he calls the effects of use and disuse, even in The Origin of Species. Darwin's idea is that habits practiced over the course of the lifetime of an individual eventually appear as instincts in offspring. So if you think that to be a Darwinian is to believe in the primacy of natural selection and the failure of Lamarckian inheritance, then you should think that Darwin wasn't really a Darwinian, because Darwin certainly does believe in Lamarckian inheritance, and in fact, later on in Darwin's work, he hardly mentions natural selection at all. His book, The Expression of Emotions, barely makes any mention of natural selection, and in fact, when it does, it's to consider that natural selection might be involved in a particular transition, and then Darwin says, but probably not, because I don't think the evidence supports it. Now, back in 2009, those of us who work on Darwin ended up giving an awful lot of talks about Darwin and Darwinism. That was the double anniversary year, the 200th anniversary of Darwin's birth, the 150th anniversary of the publication of The Origin of Species. It was a very odd year because there was a kind of, rather like the way colleges act in research fellowship competitions at the moment. They get earlier and earlier and earlier through the year because they want to grab the best candidates. Similarly, the organisers of these various events knew that 2009 was going to be really busy for Darwin events. So in fact, they even started loading them earlier, you know, right through 2008. So in 2008, and in 2009 as well, commentators on Darwin began to try and evaluate his most important contributions to science. And unsurprisingly, a lot of them rhapsodized about natural selection. So once again, here's something that Richard Dawkins wrote in a popular article back in 2008. Dawkins says, Charles Darwin had a big idea. Arguably the most powerful idea ever. This is great. These make great sort of discuss questions for tri-cross examinations. And like all the best ideas, it's beguilingly simple. In fact, it's so staggeringly elementary, so blindingly obvious, that although others before him tinkered nearby, nobody thought to look for it in the right place. Now, this notion that natural selection is a jaw-droppingly simple idea, the sort of idea that even a child could formulate, but which somehow or another none of us quite ever managed to grasp until Darwin came along, is actually, in fairness, sometimes suggested by Darwin's own work. So Darwin, the proud dad, recounted the following anecdote. Once again, just a couple of years after The Origin of Species was published, this in yet another letter, also, once again, written to Asa Gray, his botany friend at Harvard. And it concerns Darwin's son, Horace. And Horace was 11 at the time. About 11 and a half, actually. So here's what Darwin writes to Gray. Progress of education. One of my little boys, Horace, said to me, there are a terrible number of adders here, but if everyone killed as many as they could, they would sting less. I answered, of course, they would be fewer. Horace, of course, but I didn't mean that. What I meant was that the more timid adders which run away and do not sting would be saved, and after a time, none of the adders would sting. Natural selection. So Darwin's very proud of the young Horace. He's trying to suggest to Gray that, you know, even well, maybe not any 11-year-old child, but Horace at least, you know, is able to formulate this principle without any prompting. Now, I actually think it's a mistake to think of natural selection as quite such a simple idea, quite so elementary. And once we see that it's rather more complex, I think we also begin to note rather important differences between the way in which Darwin thinks of natural selection and the way in which we tend to think of natural selection today. And what I want to focus on, just for the rest of this talk, partly because I think it's a particularly instructive difference between how Darwin thinks of things in The Origin of Species and how we tend to think of things now, is the way in which Darwin insists on a struggle for existence, this notion which he gets from Thomas Malthus. So, this is something which, in his presentations of natural selection in The Origin of Species, Darwin repeats over and over again. Well, you get the overwhelming impression that it's vitally important to Darwin that the struggle for existence is extraordinarily severe. So, again, in the first edition of The Origin, quote, as more individuals are produced than can possibly survive, there must, in every case, be a struggle for existence. This is a very intense struggle. Darwin describes his own view about natural selection as, quoting again, the doctrine of Malthus applied with manifold force to the whole animal and vegetable kingdoms. And the result of this exceptionally strong struggle for existence, which is made inevitable by the fact that increase in numbers will always outstrip available food supply, makes it the case, Darwin thinks, that all but the very best adapted specimens will perish. So Darwin places enormous stress on the existence of this struggle for existence. Lots and lots of death going on, scarce resources made inevitable by geometric increase in population size. Now, what's rather odd is that when you read modern textbook presentations of evolutionary theory, they usually characterize natural selection as a process that occurs whenever you have, and then usually they say, heritable variation in fitness. Roughly speaking, what that means is that you have a process of natural selection whenever you've got a population that has a number of different forms in it. Some of them have a greater disposition to multiply than others, and those dispositions are themselves reliably inherited in subsequent generations. All you need on that view for natural selection to occur is difference in reproductive rates, and you need those differences to be the sorts of things that are passed from parent to offspring. All you need for natural selection to occur are differences in reproductive rates, regardless of whether there's the kind of scarcity of resources that this notion of Malthusian struggle seems to demand. Now, this is a point that was noted very early on by some of the major architects of what we think of as the modern view of evolution. So most obviously, people like R.A. Fisher. Okay, so Fisher, who was a fellow at Caes, noted that, in fact, the Malthusian element should really be thought of as an entirely detachable part of the theory of evolution. It's something that we should be able to drop. Fisher said that Darwin had overstated the importance of struggle in his account of selection. So here's what Fisher said, writing in 1930. The historical fact that both Darwin and Wallace were led through reading Malthus's essay on population to appreciate the efficacy of selection should no longer constrain us to confuse the consequences of that principle with its foundations. Just drop the Malthusian part. Philosopher of biology Elliot Sober made the point much more economically a lot later. Sober said, selection can modify a population even when all offspring survive. You can still have heritable variation in fitness even when everybody survives. You don't need all of this death. Now, you might say, well, Darwin always said that the struggle for existence was supposed to be metaphorical. Maybe Darwin's claims about the intensity of struggle are just a kind of cosmetic artifact of the way that he presented his view. Maybe there isn't really any important difference between Darwin's way of thinking about selection and the modern way of thinking about selection at all. Now, I don't think that's right, because I think that the way that Darwin appeals to Malthus, the way that Darwin appeals to this very intense struggle for existence, is actually essential to how Darwin thinks you should explain adaptation. I think it's essential to the way that Darwin thinks natural selection works. So here's what people sometimes say. People say that Fleming Jenkin, in a review of The Origin of Species written in 1867, alerted Darwin to a series of potentially fatal objections to his theory. Those objections concerned the problems posed to the efficacy of natural selection by the apparent phenomena of blending inheritance. The thought goes, Darwin never understood that blending could potentially be a problem for his view until he read Jenkin's review. How does the blending objection work? What's the significance of blending supposed to be for the efficacy of natural selection? Well, Darwin thought, and many of Darwin's contemporaries thought, that inheritance followed a kind of blending pattern. The traits that an offspring has are just a kind of blend, just a kind of mush, just a kind of average of the traits shown by the offspring's two parents. And then Jenkin tried to argue on mathematical grounds. Jenkin was an engineer, he knew a lot more maths than Darwin did, that if you assume, as indeed Darwin himself did, that offspring are just a blend of their parental traits, then even if it turns out, as Darwin has told us, that some individuals may rarely be blessed by traits that confer reproductive success on them, you know, maybe a particular individual is lucky enough to be a very swift runner, and as a result of that has a lot more offspring than all of the slower runners. Suppose that's true. Jenkin says, look, you've still got a problem with the idea that natural selection can promote the spread of these beneficial traits through populations. Because suppose there is indeed some single, conspicuously fast runner that does a lot better than all of its conspecifics. Well, it's going to mate with somebody. that somebody is probably going to be much closer to the population average in terms of running speed. That then means that through blending, the offspring will in turn be a little bit closer to the average than this particularly advantaged individual that we begin with. And then through a whole series of iterated cycles of reproduction with more average members and blending, any advantage that you initially have from this conspicuously beneficial trait is just washed away. And the population over time simply returns to the boring old mean that it started with. Blending, it seems, poses this fatal problem. What some people have suggested in turn is Darwin reads Jenkins' review, he thinks, oh bugger, my theory doesn't really work after all, and then he puts together a particular view about inheritance, a particular view that is indeed a particular view that says that inheritance is a matter of particles, which he then puts forward in a later book from 1868, The Variation of Animals and Plants Under Domestication. Now, this is all a big mistake. Right? This is all a mistaken way of understanding, I think, what's going on in terms of Darwin's handling of these potential worries posed by blending. If you really thought, as some people have suggested, that Darwin's view about inheritance, the so-called hypothesis of pangenesis, was really intended as a way of showing that natural selection can work even in spite of Jenkins' arguments about blending, then what you'd imagine is that while pangenesis doesn't feature in the early editions of The Origin, you'd imagine it would feature very prominently in the much later editions of The Origin. But it doesn't. In The Origin's fifth edition from 1869, published well after the pangenesis hypothesis was developed, it's not mentioned. In the sixth edition from 1872, pangenesis is still barely mentioned. It seems that Darwin doesn't really think that his views about inheritance have very much purchase at all on the general case that he wants to make for natural selection. Here's what I think is instead going on. I think Darwin understood really rather early on in his career that there might be an obstacle posed to the efficacy of natural selection by these phenomena of blending. It's not the case that Darwin had never considered the worries posed by blending until he read this review from Jenkins. Even while Darwin was writing the first edition of The Origin, he was worried that potentially beneficial effects of selection could be undermined by blending, particularly by what Darwin calls crossing, just by mating. And I think that the reason why Darwin invokes this struggle for existence of exceptional intensity is because he thinks, maybe rightly, maybe wrongly, Darwin thinks that if the struggle for existence is extraordinarily strong, then it can help to counteract the otherwise detrimental effects of blending inheritance. So in the first edition of The Origin, he says, the process of selection will often be greatly retarded by free intercrossing. Many will exclaim that these several causes are amply sufficient wholly to stop the action of natural selection. I do not believe so. When he writes the first edition of The Origin of Species, Darwin has a clear view that that inheritance does indeed take on this blending pattern, but he thinks he's got an answer, even at that early stage, regardless of what Jenkins says later on. Here's how I think Darwin thinks about these things. Darwin says, look, we know, Darwin doesn't even think that we do know, although now we deny this, Darwin says, look, we know that inheritance follows this blending pattern. Something biologists today would deny, but Darwin thought it was the case. We know inheritance follows this blending pattern, and we also know that in spite of blending in inheritance, we've had plenty of success in terms of improving various breeds of domesticated species. We've managed to improve species of sheep, species of cattle, and so on, even with blending. How do we do that? What is it that breeders know that enables them to improve species, to increase the level of adaptation in species, in spite of apparent blending? Darwin says, well, the answer there is very simple. A good breeder a good animal breeder simply doesn't allow poor specimens to reproduce. A good breeder only mates the very best specimens with each other. That's how they bring about improvement over time. So there's no problem with producing adaptation, with producing improvement on the farm, Darwin thinks, even with blending inheritance. All you've got to do is make sure that only the very best specimens get to reproduce with each other. And that's how you stop these cycles of blending and mating, causing the population to kind of wash back towards the boring initial mean. And then Darwin says, what we need to do is find something analogous in nature to the skilled, refined hand of the breeder. And that's why Darwin says that the struggle for existence needs to be extraordinarily strong. The struggle for existence needs to be extraordinarily strong because that allows natural selection to do in the wild precisely what the skilled breeder does on the farm. Only the very best specimens get to reproduce at all. Why? Because the struggle for existence is so extraordinarily strong that all but the very best specimens end up perishing. That is how Darwin proposes, well before Jenkins' review, to answer worries posed by blending. We tend not to notice that these days. We tend not to notice this rather odd, rather weird aspect of Darwin's theorising. One of the reasons I think why we don't notice it is because Darwin consistently talks about natural selection working on slight differences. Now today, if we have a biological training, we tend to think slight differences means slight in terms of effects on fitness. Surely one might think a slight variation is one that gives only a tiny advantage in terms of reproductive output. But I don't think that's how Darwin thinks of it at all. When Darwin says variations are slight, what he means is that they are anatomically or physiologically or behaviorally of a small magnitude. But because Darwin thinks that the struggle for existence is exceptionally strong, even a very tiny difference in terms of magnitude can make a massive difference in terms of prospects for overall survival and reproduction. So moving a little bit later in Darwin's work, on variation in plants and animals under domestication, Darwin considers the example of a giraffe with a slightly longer neck, and Darwin says it would, during a dearth, have a slight advantage in being able to browse on higher twigs and thus survive, but then he says a few mouthfuls more or less every day would make all the difference between life and death. Small differences turn out to have very great significance. Elsewhere in the same book, once again written in 1868, Darwin looks back 9 years on The Origin of Species, and he reminds us that, quoting again, it was there shown that all organic beings, without exception, tend to increase at so high a ratio that no district, no station, not even the whole surface of the land, or the whole ocean would hold the progeny of a single pair after a certain number of generations. The inevitable result is an ever-recurrent struggle for existence. The severe and often recurrent struggle for existence will determine that those variations, however slight, which are favourable shall be preserved or selected, and those which are unfavourable shall be destroyed. So once again, Darwin is espousing this extremely strong conception of struggle for existence. That strong conception is present, I think, in the first edition of The Origin. It's also present in Darwin's later work on variation. It's also present earlier in Darwin's notebooks, those much earlier speculations from the 30s. So, for example, in Darwin's notebook E, he calls my principle the, quoting again, the destruction of all the less hardy ones and the preservation of accidental hardy seedlings. Now, it seems to me that we should read Darwin in a very full-blooded manner here. So the struggle for existence isn't merely something that weeds out those specimens that happen to be towards the bottom end of the curve. Rather, selection is eliminating all the less hardy ones, i.e. all but the very hardiest. Darwin's commitment to this exceptionally strong struggle is borne out by the difficulty he has in believing in what he calls, quoting again, the dreadful but quiet war of organic beings, when he goes into what he again calls the peaceful woods and smiling fields. It's hard to see why Darwin would have so much difficulty if all selection does is weed out a few of the least well-adapted specimens. Darwin says that there's a contest and a grain of sand turns the balance. So these slight differences in organic structure make all the difference in the world for an organism's prospects. So, I think that Darwin's way of understanding natural selection is really quite different to standard presentations of modern ways of understanding selection and evolution. Darwin says that the struggle for existence is extraordinarily severe. He even thinks, for reasons I could go into later, that the tendency to vary in a particular direction is itself something that's inherited, and so forth. Darwin introduces these assumptions not merely for cosmetic reasons. Darwin introduces these assumptions because they're essential to his way of understanding how we should explain adaptation. And they're essential to that way of understanding adaptation because Darwin also thinks, in a way that we would disagree with, that inheritance works through a blending pattern. So Darwin is confronting the problems posed by patterns of inheritance head on, and he's offering one rather particular set of solutions to how adaptation can be brought about. In contrast to that, Fisher, over in Keyes, famously argued for an entirely different view, and that is very much the view that we hold today. Fisher's view is that if instead of thinking of selection as inheritance as taking a blending pattern, if instead you think of selection as based on the transmission of discrete particles, then selection can proceed in a very powerful manner, even with very frequent crossing, even with very small fitness advantages, even with a very low mutation rate. That's entirely different to Darwin's view, because if you translate Darwin's view back into the modern idiom, what Darwin is really doing is he's insisting on infrequent crossing, very large fitness advantages, and a very high mutation rate. The package that Darwin offers us is very, very different to the one that we have today. Okay, now let me say a few more words and then I'll end. I guess these kinds of talks are supposed to celebrate particular authors and celebrate their works, and you might think that what I've said is somewhat inappropriate, actually, for this because you might say, well, Lewins has effectively told us that Darwin just got everything wrong, because we don't think selection works in anything like the way that Darwin said. So what's so great about the origin of species after all? Surely what I've done is I've undermined Darwin's reputation instead of doing what you're meant to do on this kind of occasion, which is boosted. Well, I don't think that's the moral we should draw from this at all, but before I explain why not, I want to consider once again some of the comments that Dawkins makes about selection. So Dawkins doesn't just say that natural selection is the correct explanation for adaptation. Dawkins tends to say much stronger things. It's not just that natural selection happens to be right. Dawkins says natural selection is the only possible explanation for adaptation. It's not just true, it's guaranteed to be true, Dawkins says. Now, if you thought that was right, I suppose one thing that you might say is, look, maybe Darwin didn't get the details right. Maybe Darwin was wrong about blending and wrong about the precise role of the struggle for existence and all of that, you know, fiddly kind of stuff. But at least Darwin got the basic idea right. You know, it's something about inherited variations being beneficial and that meaning that you get adaptation over time. Roughly speaking, got the gist of it. Maybe that's why we should celebrate Darwin. Now, there's a worry about defending Darwin's reputation in that kind of way. If you decide to defend Darwin's reputation by saying, oh, he managed to formulate an abstract explanatory principle that was generically along the right lines, even though he got all the details wrong. Then it looks as though you should start casting your net a bit more widely. You should start asking questions like, well, was there anybody else who formulated a kind of broadly speaking, plausible, abstract set of explanatory conditions and also got all the details wrong? Because if there is, then they should share the credit equally with Darwin on this view. And there were such people. So everyone's heard of Charles Darwin. Hardly anyone has heard of Patrick Matthew. Loads of people have read The Origin of Species. Almost nobody has read On Naval Timber and Arboriculture from 1831, preceding The Origin of Species by fully 28 years. And in that book, not even in the book, I think in the appendix to that book, actually, Matthew puts forward an idea that sounds an awful lot like these abstract versions of natural selection. Now, historians of biology are very well aware of Matthew's work. The usual reaction of historians to Matthew's work is they say, look, Darwin didn't just formulate an abstract principle of natural selection. He did far, far more than that. He tried to apply it as an explanatory principle to a very wide range of cases. He tried to establish the reality of natural selection by scrupulously investigating its empirical presuppositions. He asked, what precisely is the nature of variation? What precisely is the nature of inheritance? To what extent has artificial selection been efficacious, and to what extent might we extrapolate from the successes of artificial selection to the efficacy of natural selection? In following up all of those subsidiary or ancillary questions, Darwin tried to give an empirical footing to natural selection that had never been achieved before. He made natural selection visible, influential, respectable to a large community of natural historians. Now that standard response, I think, is ample to cement Darwin's reputation. It's also worth pointing out that that standard view among historians, namely that what Darwin does isn't just formulate an abstract principle, but applies it in all of its fiddly, laborious, painstaking detail. That's exactly the way that not just Darwin, but even the way that Patrick Matthew seemed to understand things. So, in The Origin's third edition, which appeared in 1861, just a couple of years after the first edition, Darwin added a historical sketch. The historical sketch was a reflection on some noteworthy ancestors of Darwin's own views. He reflected explicitly on Matthew's own contribution. This is a long quotation, but I think it's worth reading out in full. Darwin says, in 1831, Mr. Patrick Matthew published his work on naval timber and arboriculture, in which he gives precisely the same view on the origin of species as that, presently to be alluded to, propounded by Mr. Wallace and myself in the Linnaean Journal, and as that enlarged on in the present volume, i.e. The Origin of Species. Darwin continues. And you'll see there's a whole list of highly noteworthy publications that are going to appear. In answer to a letter of mine published in Gardner's Chronicle, April the 13th, fully acknowledging that Mr. Matthew had anticipated me, he, with generous candour, wrote a letter, Gardner's Chronicle, May the 12th, containing the following passage. Okay, so now we've got a quote within a quote. This is now Darwin quoting Matthew's Gardner's Chronicle response. So now this is Matthew. I guess if I was really good at voices, I'd do my Charles Darwin doing Matthew voice. That outstrips me. To me, the conception of this law of nature came intuitively as a self-evident fact, almost without an effort of concentrated thought. Mr. Darwin here seems to have more merit in the discovery than I have had. To me, it did not appear a discovery. He seems to have worked it out by inductive reason, slowly, and with due caution to have made his way synthetically from fact to fact onwards. While with me it was by a general glance at the scheme of nature that I estimated this select production of species as an a priori recognisable fact, an axiom requiring only to be pointed out to be admitted by unprejudiced minds of sufficient grasp. Now, one reason why this is an interesting quotation here is because Matthew himself seems to be confessing that for him, the principle of natural selection was an a priori principle. It was an intuitive claim that could be easily grasped by anyone without having to do any real research, much like Horace Darwin managed to articulate it. Now, on some modern readings, the principle of natural selection does have the character of an a priori mathematical truth. The principle of natural selection says something like, if one type has a greater tendency to reproduce its kind than another, then in the long run we should expect the latter to outcompete the former. Patrick Matthew, ironically rather like Richard Dawkins, really does, or really did, conceive of natural selection as an extraordinarily simple, self-evident idea, which Matthew also thought may have considerable explanatory power. Darwin's own way of thinking of natural selection is really rather different. It's not an abstract principle that can be grasped a priori. Darwin's way of understanding what natural selection is incorporates a very detailed set of attempts to fill out precisely how inheritance is supposed to work, precisely what sorts of environmental conditions are most conducive for selection to act, and so on and so forth. So I think if we say what makes Darwin a great guy, Darwin's the hero of modern evolutionary biology, not so much because he was the first person to formulate a very abstract explanatory idea. Instead, it's because Darwin was the first person to build in great empirical detail an explanatory system, backed up by massive amounts of data, applied in nuanced ways over the whole gamut of biological phenomena, which had a version of natural selection at its core. And many modern biologists are seeking to do something rather different, albeit with a rather different version of natural selection in mind. Now, in that sense, I think that Darwin can act as an exemplar for modern biology, and The Origin of Species can act as an exemplar for modern biological works. Their reputation remains perfectly intact.